My name is Vern Fiatat, and I am almost through a two-week series, which is entitled The Jesus in the Shadow. This series is a series of Bible conversations and discussions about a random selection of biblical texts, which are selected because they help us understand something of the ambiguity and complexity and painfulness that is a part of the history of the people of God as reflected in the words of the prophets and the apostles, and is part of the experience of Jesus of Nazareth as epitomized in his suffering and in his death. The text for the day is Matthew 21, 33 to 46, the well-known parable of the wicked tenants. It was selected because that text is implicated and associated in Christian minds with some of the permission given in Western society that led to the Holocaust of the massacre in the ovens of about 5 million Jewish folk in our century, and probably in my lifetime. And so that we are introduced with this text not only to the shadows, but to the pain in the shadows of our society and history, and pain in the groans within the community of faith. I hope that this journey will make it safer for us and I am indebted to my spouse, Billy, for this word, to befriend the pain of the church and to befriend our own pain and to befriend to the pain of Jesus. And if historic Christians are correct, there is some sense, although it's hard to put it in words, and it seems like most of the time when we put it into words, the words turn out not to be good enough. If historic Christian hope is correct, there is some sense in which if we are able to befriend Jesus of Nazareth as he dies, we will learn something about what it means to befriend God. And in a world running down and withering and sooner or later dying, God, as well as most of us, probably needs some friends. The image of befriending God comes from What's the name of the poem, Larry? Bonhoeffer's poem. You know?
Christians and Pagans.
Yeah. Okay. The introduction turned into the summary of the series. Now we need a prayer. Spirit of life, scorch us with your fire. Mess us with your wind. Cleanse us, wash us with the turbulence of living, rushing water. Breathe upon us. Burn us, wash us, for Jesus' sake, for our neighbor's sake, for the world's sake. Amen. One of my friends in the first session tells me I am a random, my learning style is random, intuitive, or something. And so those of you who are sequential learners, we got to try to live together. But I have begun to accept the fact that when I wake up in the morning, I am a printout with a bunch of images and incomplete sentences and things like that. And so, literally, I learned something from Larry. Larry is a very comforting person. Is a very comforting person to have in the village at the same time. And I've been here more than once when I was slightly beat up, and it was very comforting to have him here. So, and Nyla. I mean, I don't think Larry would be as comforting if Nyla wasn't there. So I think there's something going on that I'm not clear about. But anyhow. The river, the water, let the fire burn, let the spirit blow, let the wind blow, let the river flow. Finn.
Which one?
Thank you for telling me that the image of Railroad Creek was important. And I told it to my wife, and she affirmed it, so I'm sure it's right. My most sacred space at Holden is sitting next to either 10 Mile Creek Falls, or up by where you used to be able to walk out to the rock and you can hear Railroad Creek, because then I am almost in the middle of the river. Now, I'm trying to figure out why that is so calming and safe. And why do I get in touch with serenity and moments of stillness in a place like this? And my image is, I think that most of our civilization is something like living in a concrete box with asbestos lining where you manage everything by a keyboard. Okay? And you feel safe from the dragons and demons and principalities and powers because there are some sight barriers between you and some link fences and all that sort of stuff. And the reason I think, the reason I thought, think this morning that I can feel a little safer, I get in touch with this inner sense of safety or acceptance here is that I can sit next to the violence and turbulence of the water in a safe place and discover that it's safe to be alongside of turbulence. I can be safe in the middle of turbulence. Okay? If I can befriend it, I can be safe in the middle of the chaos of the Bible if I can befriend it. I can have hope and trust when Jesus is getting killed through some mystery of being. Another image, and somebody else can put them together, but my wife has become a symbol of something for me, and she's been down in bed for a couple days, and when my wife is down in bed, her strategy is to befriend her pain and she heals faster. My guess is, Nyla, that you spend your life trying to teach women to go with labor pains, right? Is that right? And then the birth is easier and happier. Now that's an image. If you don't talk to Nyla, I don't know what to deal. I don't know how to deal. Okay. But anyhow, there's something going on. There's something slightly mysterious going on in all of this. And all right, images. So the Bible is a rushing stream and. The river runs through it, and Jesus is a turbulent, ambiguous, haunting figure. And God willing, the church can be a place where we can befriend Jesus rather than build up barriers and put pictures of Jesus on the walls. Okay. Now, what's this got to do with this? The grossest in my growing up, the grossest, least ambiguous example of violence and evil, most persuasive, was the Holocaust, where reasonably decent, well-educated, sophisticated people who had great music and great poetry and great theologies, Roman Catholic and Lutheran, reasonably decent people decided that the primitive system of stoning to death the scapegoats was the best way of cleansing Germany of its diseases, and they burned up in ovens about 5 million people. And the Jews were an endangered species before that happened, and when 5 million of an endangered species gets extinct by deliberate, intentional, and by undeliberate acquiescence on the part of neighbors and the silent majority. If I were, what's a, name me an endangered species, please.
The condor.
All right, if I was a spotted owl or a condor, I would feel a little bit scared. And the way in which Christians act like they were afraid of Jews, and so they would lock them in the ghettos at night, and they didn't, in the imperial times, they didn't burn them up as much, but they did lock them up, and they put different kinds of rules on them, and they prevented them from any access to power. They just gave them the jobs that, because they were decent Christians, they couldn't do, like lending money charging interest and things like that, because there's rules in the Bible about not charging interest and that sort of thing. So we acted like we were very afraid of them, and somehow you pick something that you're afraid of and you let that be the symbol of everything that threatens you about your life, and then you get rid of that and you feel better. But let me tell you just a little common sense secret. I mean, and it's perfectly obvious. Who's a safe person? Oh, you're a safe person. If I make you a symbol of what's wrong with me and string you up. But what's wrong with me is not him. Supposing what's wrong with me is that I'm scared to death. Supposing what's wrong with me is I don't know how to keep my money together or something like that. And supposing what's wrong with me is I've lived in a hothouse so long that I'm scared to death that I'll fall in the creek. Now, if what's wrong with me is that, and I make him a symbol of what's wrong with me, I will feel better when I get rid of him. So I have solved my problem of feeling scared all the time. But I haven't gotten rid of it underneath. And so when the euphoria of raping him wears off, I'm going to feel sick again. And the euphoria since the Holocaust, the euphoria of getting rid of our ills by getting rid of the Jews has worn off. Okay, morally sensitive Bible study. It has to do with both reading rather honestly the complex moral situations that are really, I think, exhibited in the text and are not as tidy as the spiritualities and the theologies that we use to get closure. Now, I am not knocking closure. I think we need creeds, we need spiritualities, we need systems, we need exercises. We need exercises. Anderson, you and I had a discussion. We need exercises over here. So when we go out in the wilderness, we can have muscles that will deal with the up and down. So I need to belong to a church that has exercises and discipline and coherence so I can cope with the wilderness. Okay? But supposing that the Bible and Jesus are a piece of the wilderness, not the setting up exercises which I need to get ready. Supposing that the Bible and Jesus are like Railroad Creek. And they are, in fact, turbulent places where reality and the sacred bump each other. And I go to those places to be able to experience again the awesomeness in life. So when I start climbing the mountain, I'll have some energy and some hope. But I also need to belong to communities where I learn exercises and put closure and find, take the wildness of the fire and save a piece so I can cook and take the bit of the wind and turn it into electricity and take a bit of the wildness of the river and heat the hot water. Okay, you're getting my image. Do you get my image? You see the image? Okay, back to the text, or into the text, finally. I want to bomb through the first part of this text. I've got to give a commercial because some of you, I had some books in the bookstore, and these books might be ways that some of you could carry on the conversation with yourself. For those of you who do not know what this is a Gospel Parallels, and it's Matthew, Mark, and Luke in parallel columns, so you can see exactly the variety of interpretations and begin to tune in to the kind of conversation and discussion that's going on inside the Bible. The reason that this kind of way of studying the Bible is important, and especially when I shut up, is that it gives you a sense of what it was like to be in the early church, where there were different congregations which had different Jesus stories. And the Bible, like it or not, is a slice of the life out of early church, not too tidied up. Not too tidied up. And the less tidy it is, the more you know that you're getting closer to what real life was like. Okay. I like this book because it tells you about all the political movements in Palestine and in a novel-like form. And so it helps you get over the idea that Jesus, like Mork, came spaced out of Mars. The fact of the matter is that Jesus grew up as a kid and he visited John the Baptist, who probably had visited Qumran, and he hung out and knew what the high priests were like, and he knew what was going on, and he learned a lot from the Pharisees. In fact, he argues just like a good Pharisee. And he knew what the Zealots were doing, and he knew there were Romans in Palestine beating up on people. And this helped you recover the social location and get over one of the greatest superstitions of American society. Is that, I mean, all of behavioral science has worked on the principle that somehow the individual and the community are somehow interdependent, and then we come along, and what most of us really believe is that there's a self in us someplace that has nothing whatever to do with culture or society, and if we just find our true self, we will be pure, distilled, Spirit. I think that's superstitious, frankly. Shadow of the Galilean, Gerd Tyson. If any of you have libraries, he has a 350-page book that documents what he says in his little novel. Jesus, a New Vision by Marcus Borg. Oregon, those of you who live on the West Coast could get to come in and talk to your congregations. Read the book and then get him to come in for a Saturday and talk about the book. Jesus and the Spirit, it shows the inward journey, Jesus and culture, and so you get a sense of a Jesus who has an inner journey and has an outer journey. What makes you think you can have either an inner journey or an outer journey? What makes you think you can have either a self or a neighbor? I'm stuck with both. I don't like it. I can handle only one at a time. But that's by doing some rather fantastic kind of illusions. You know, I go into fantasy and pretend my neighbors don't live next door to me, or my wife doesn't live in the same house, and something like that. But anyhow, you got to do those things. But the fact of the matter is, we've got both, and Jesus had both. I've started using Maya Angelou because there's a woman who exudes melody, hopeful melodies. And she reminds me of hearing Marian Anderson sing There's a Balm in Gilead. And when Marian Anderson sang There's a Balm in Gilead, it didn't sound like my choir when they sang it. It sounded like somebody who had experienced pain. And the pain and the hope were in the song together. The pain and the hope were in the song together. It's something like singing Den Storavide Flock at a funeral. Doesn't sound the same when you sing it at confirmation. But when you sing Den Storavide Flock at a funeral, and people who are in pain articulate hope. That's a real story, folks. That's the real story. That's the real story. Okay, so I've done Maya Angelou because there's a lot of grief and pain and darkness in her life, and she's a very hopeful presence, as I'm sure most of you know. And there are lots of other examples. One of the ironic blessings of being in places, being in an emergency room where all the catastrophes, and some of us, at least those of us who live on college campuses and have waves of liberation come regularly, and each time it's a different wave. And one of the providences of that, though, is that you learn hope in the midst of pain. You learn from people who are owning their pain and still have hope. And it's very helpful. It's very helpful. And so there are women who have begun to find, who have clearly found strong melodies of hope within their pain and oppression. There are blacks. There are gays and lesbians. There are third world poor Christians. There are first world poor. I think that some white males are tuning into their pain. I think most of us are still in the closet. And it's not very comfortable. as some of you well know, because it is not safe in American society for males, and particularly white males who have access to all the structures of the power, more privilege, even if they don't feel like it. Appear on stage as the power person, either because you're the accountable person for all the shit, or because you're the accountable person for fixing it, it is not very comfortable to feel powerless when the only public role for a white male is a power role. Okay, having said all of that, the pain that I want you to look at this morning is the pain of Jews. Contemporary Jews, ancient Jews. The reason that this is an important issue for studying the Gospels is that there are texts in the Gospels that have either implicitly or explicitly, whether they be Christ killers, the Jews crucified Jesus, quote unquote, the Gospel of John, whether they are explicit or implicit, like the text today, they are implicated in the social structures and the social process which gave permission to the Holocaust. And what I'm talking about is, as these 5 million people were getting fed to the furnace, there were quiet Christians who were praying for God to end the Nazi terror. And there was American leadership who were probably saying something like, we've got to wait a little longer so we won't lose so many American lives. And in the meantime, 5 million endangered species humans got fed to the furnace group by group, and some of those really decent, civilized Germans went home to dinner, maybe said grace, took their wives to the symphony, and listened to excruciatingly gorgeous music, and tried to forget the horror of the workplace so they could go to work in the morning. Morally sensitive exegesis means not only facing up to the problems in the text that the text has caused, but I think it means developing the kind of imaginative conscience so that when you see texts that can go awry, you warn people. Now, originally, the sermon was supposed to take what was dangerous in the text and deal with it, but sermons are on street corners, and they have to do many other things as well. And my suggestion is, if you've got a church, if you've got a congregation where the sermon shouldn't be doing that, then you ought to have comments before or after you read the lesson, or you ought to put program notes in the bulletin. You do it when you go to the symphony orchestra, and although it's a waste of paper, it's a good cause, because it's better to... if the chips are down, I would rather lose one dead tree than one living Jew. But I hope the chips aren't that way. But I hope that if we listen to Larry, maybe we can figure out how to set it up so it won't happen, so we won't have to make that kind of choice. But you can tell what kind of a world I live in. All right, now you got the back to the text. What? Huh? Say something.
He said that's a large charge.
The text.
Listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard, put a fence around it, dug a wine press in it, and built a watchtower. Then he leased it to tenants. You all remember the Song of the Vineyard in Isaiah 5. And in the Song of, just to refresh your memory, in the Song of the Vineyard, here's this person who clears all the rubble, gets it shaped up, and then the crop that comes is sour grapes, and so he can't make wine. And so what's he going to do? He's going to walk away and let the vineyard go back to being wilderness. So the economic circumstances have changed. He's not doing it by himself. Now he's made enough money that he can rent it out to tenants and go to the coast and lay on the beach. And the tenant, and he's got another kind of problem. He dug a wine press in it, then he leased it to tenants and went to another country. And when the harvest time had come, meaning when the grapes were ready to pick and sell, he sent slaves to the tenants to collect his produce, but the tenants seized the slaves, and they beat one, killed another, stoned another. He sent three, okay. Common sense. If they ask for the money, get rid of the messenger, but not common sense. And he sent another set of slaves. They did the same way, and he thinks, oh, now if I send the guy who has the real power in his back pocket, the person who will own this vineyard, they'll have some basic respect for this sort of person. But they kill him too. They kill the heir. Now, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what do you think he's going to do to the tenants? In my reading, I hear the tones of Jesus' voice stop there. Is there any question? Certainly not in the ancient world. Nowadays, you'd say you'd hire a good lawyer and take him to court. But in the ancient world, there is no question. In the ancient world, you had the quick, easy way of killing people to get rid of the problems. Okay, and if you want to see the example of ancient world justice, look at Leviticus. Okay, I mean, and there's something common sense about this. The third world still operates on this principle. If a man abuses a woman, adultery, kill him. If a man abuses a man, what the Bible calls homosexuality, kill them. If somebody exploits somebody else, kill them. The best way to get rid of the people who exploit people is to get rid of them. Well, maybe putting him in prison is a substitute for killing him, you know. But it's a more complicated, high-cost process, and it's a high-tech process. The simple, low-tech process, this is just kill, get him, stone him to death. All right. So the logic of, but notice what I did to that Leviticus text. The reality under that text is exploitation. Not some particular pattern of human relationship. The reality under that text is when people in power hurt people who have less power. That's when you need justice. And it's out of those kinds of situations that the Jews got the notion that God was just. It does not do any good to have in this world to believe in a God who is not just and is not about righting. Okay, well, anyhow, the text. Again, he sent other slaves, and so what will they do, what will the owner of the vineyard do when he went due to those tenants? And of course they said to him, he'll put the wretches to a miserable death, and he'll rent the vineyard out to better tenants, you know, to other tenants. Who will give him the produce? What on earth good does it do to have people run your farm if they can't produce a decent crop? What good does it do to give power to a species for the universe if they can't take care of it? And of course, if the person cares about the whole shebang, they're going to find some other way of doing it. Will somebody who has a tough heart volunteer to read the rest of the text? Somebody who isn't afraid of pain. Well, somebody who's foolish. Will a fool rush in where angels fear to tread? Please, Libby.
Jesus saith unto them, did ye never read in the scriptures, the stone which the builder rejected, the same is to become the head of the corner. This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore I say unto you, the kingdom of God shall be taken from you and given to a nation bringing forth the fruit thereof. And whosoever shall fall onto this stone shall be broken. But on whomsoever it shall fall, it will grind him to powder. And when the chief priests and Pharisees had heard his parables, they perceived that he spake of them. But when they sought to lay hands on him, they feared the multitude, because they took him for a prophet.
I want to give you two pieces of information. One is that the stone quote is a quote from the Hebrew Scriptures, because of course that was the Bible of the early Christians, because they were Jewish. Psalm 118, 22-23. The other piece of information is that verse 43, which is the killer, does not appear in Mark and Luke, but it does appear in Matthew. Now, having said those two things, I wish, what do you want to do with this text? What on earth are we going to do with this text?
Say some more about that.
Can anybody say what I'm thinking? I've talked too much.
How can we use the text so that it isn't anti-Semitic?
Right. How can we read this text so that a Jew doesn't get scared to death? Because when a Jew or a sensitive, consciousness-raised Christian hears this text, they think of the very repeated exegesis for the last 2,000 years, since about the 3rd century anyhow, when Christians have used this text to say that the Jews did not produce the fruits of salvation, therefore God took them, took the covenant and gave it to the Christians. Now, this is a very dangerous logic. It's a very destructive, let me say, it's a deadly logic for two reasons. One, it gave permission to traditional Christians to be either anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, or latently anti-Semitic, And it is my hunch that three-quarters of the Christian church is latently anti-Semitic. And I think any Jew has to be afraid of Christians in order to stay a Jew. The second thing is, the next sequence in the logic is, if God is just, and God did that to the Jews because they didn't produce good crops, well, of course, he's about to do that to the Christians. The Christian crop these days is pretty puny. Let's face it, the corn is malnourished. And if that's what happens to the people who the first set of tenants, then don't think that the second set of tenants are going to have a different, are going to get a different deal if that's the way the owner operates. You know? I mean, just follow your logic. So that's a very uncomfortable trend. Do you see what I'm talking about? There's a hand. I don't have a clue to the face.
I think that the way we use it, Vern, is you begin by the misreading over many decades, maybe centuries, of metaphor and actually the way that this has been allegorized. You begin by displacing where we usually see ourselves, or where who we identify as the various parts of this story. And I think that the way you've just done it with us may be too long for a sermon, but it's precisely that kind of leading into the story where you don't allow people to say those guys over there are the ones that did this to Jesus. And you start by realigning the parable or the parts of this metaphor. Or actually, this is a parable. So
I know where you've been, Carol. Yeah. I hear where you've been. I don't know where you're going.
Well, I think if you want it to be funded, instead of starting a sermon in the usual declarative manner, to go down and say, to ask people who these people represent, and see if you can't get some way of turning that so that you don't get out of the story by foisting it off on saying, well,
who do you think they represent?
I'll let somebody else answer that.
So who was it? Somebody told me this week that people don't give up an answer they know is wrong unless they give them another answer to try. So unless you can find a better scapegoat, people are going to go on using the Jews.
Well, I think you have to replace something. You have to get them in the story instead of them being the critics about what happened back here. Where is this now about how we as the Christian church are bearing fruit or not?
I have a cynical theory that the Jews are a little safer in the United States because we've got blacks to scapegoat.
Yeah.
I think what you just said a little while ago probably is, to me it means more that we're the second tenant. And we're the second renters, or whatever you want to call it, and we are in no better, we're in no safer. And the things that we do and we're saying, and we're just as sloppy as the first and we stand the same chance of being of losing our land.
Do you think the first tenants were good people or bad people?
I don't know if that has anything what Jesus was trying to say. Does
oh,
it?
Okay.
I think they're just as depraved as we are.
Yeah.
So they're just as bad as we are.
Just as bad.
I remember hearing an African woman make a public speech. She was not a public speaker, but was in a class to learn public speaking. And she started off by saying, "It's hard to be the beloved of your father." And she developed the story explaining how because her father favored her, she had to stay home and missed out going to school, as all her brothers and sisters had a chance to do. Maybe it was hard for the Jews to be the chosen people of God and to be picked out. One can go back and ask, what did God have in mind picking them in the first place? What was his purpose? And surely it was that every nation through Abraham would be blessed. And so I read in 2 Peter the same image about the stone which the builders rejected has become the head of the corner. And we get into the verse that says, but you, which means those who now follow the Jew through whom the promises were fulfilled, you are the chosen race, a royal priesthood, a royal nation, God's own people, that you may declare the wonderful deeds of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were no people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. And it's not easy to be the, it's not an easy life to be the one God has chosen to be the height that brings the living water to the rest of the world. But that's exactly what he's called all of us to be. And it doesn't mean, I think it's a total misreading of the text to feel that we have a right to judge the Jews. Instead, I feel we must be in the train of those who were chosen. And I feel a great debt of gratitude to the Jewish nation, of the Jewish people, because they were the chosen and are still the beloved of the Lord. And doesn't Paul in the book of Romans warn us that the branch which was transplanted into the vine will be cut off just as another branch was if it doesn't fulfill the fruit bearing? It's not easy to be God's beloved, but we are, and we're chosen to bear fruit, that God's, that Christ's name may be lifted up. And we preach, we speak of the wonderful acts of God.
That's great.
I stopped.
I took too much time, and so we need more voices.
I'm a little nervous about the part where the chief priests and the Pharisees, the leaders, the religious leaders, perceive that he spoke of them. And the multitude took him for a prophet, which sort of is intriguing of was it taken from the religious leadership and given to the multitude, kind of thing. That's a little disturbing.
Basic problem. The word Pharisee, down through Christian history, has become symbol of hypocrite, person who says one thing and does another. Okay? The word Pharisee down through Jewish history has become to Jews, like the word apostles, people who lived with an awful lot of grief and figured out a way to follow the law, figured out a way to love God and love their neighbor in spite of losing their land, their temple, their power, and everything. So Pharisee is a symbol of strength, of how to debate and allow consensus to happen slowly. And so Pharisee is a holy word, a saint symbol. Basic problem. When a word, and the truth of the matter is that the 20th century scholars think that the Jewish reading of the Pharisees is more historically accurate than the Christian reading of the Pharisees. Okay, basic problem. When my symbolic, when my saints become symbols of your demons, you have got a clash of symbols of the holy, which sets up a situation which is very easily exploited for violence. Very easily. We're going to talk about that in the forum tonight. Amen. And good keep. I thank you. More comments on the text?
Well, just this, are we to accept the historical evaluation of the Pharisee or the evaluation of him who was qualified to make the judgment? Jesus pronounced in Matthew 23, the seven woes. They sensed he was speaking to them, but having abdicated their responsibility.
The question I have for you was, Jesus a Pharisee arguing with other Pharisees, or was he a Christian arguing with Jews?
I present to you that he was a divine, omnipotent God.
I guess the thing that we haven't talked about.
I present to you that Jesus is a human being that fully spoke for God.
I accept your presentation.
Thank you. I accept you.
The thing that we haven't talked about is this whole notion of the very stone which the builders rejected, which did not even catch my attention before today, but is the point that the Jews became overly focused and nationalistic or whatever, and that the original idea was that they would be a voice for God, and that in sort of cutting off the Gentiles, that was the problem, that they rejected people, a certain group of people. And the uncomfortable part of the text then becomes, have Christians walled themselves in too much? And, like, who are we rejecting? What faiths are we rejecting, or what groups of people are we rejecting? And does that have an implication for us as tenants of the field, if we accept the fact that we even fit that?
Does anybody know what time it is?
10.
I have a Jewish response to I, as a Jew, if I were speaking for Jews, I would have a mixed response, a yes and a no to your thing. Anybody want to do a last word? Jesus was a Jew. And I have learned most of what I learn about God from a Jew who died. And I have learned a great deal of, I have learned to experience and feel the pain of that Jew, because I, by accident, have known some Jews in the 20th century who experienced the pain of the Holocaust. So my testimony is that I have learned the most about the pain of God by being with people who are befriending and being healed in their pain. Please worry about this text. Please worry about this text. It's a very troublesome text. That's it.